And welcome to State of the Revolution. The political revolution gathering across the country today is led from the grassroots up, powered by people from across the political spectrum, organized by our common values, goals, and circumstances. The revolution is a movement beholden to no political party, organized to find, understand, and use the tools available to change the world, modifying or building new tools as necessary. Our election system is a tool designed by wealthy white men who owned land, kept slaves, and feared democracy. Designed to ensure perpetual rule by the tiny minority of people just like them. For centuries, our forebears have fought, bled, and died to expand the vote to black, female, and poor people. They left us a tool better than the one they found. It's our turn. Under these circumstances, how can we make the best use of the tools at hand? On November 6th, we're headed to the polls for one of the most consequential elections in recent memory. For many progressives and leftists, the question arises again, vote for a candidate who doesn't represent some, most, or any of our values, or vote for a third party or independent candidate who may better represent our values, but is unlikely to win. To discuss how best to use the tools at hand, my guests today are Jennifer Kurland, Green Party candidate for governor of Michigan, Ayman Kafaji, vice chair of the Michigan Democratic Party Progressive Caucus, and my co-host is Tanya Sharon, a longtime Michigan progressive activist. So, full disclosure to everybody, Tanya is actually my mother, and we've been having this conversation about how to use the electoral process and who to vote for and why for about 35 years now. You have a really interesting story of how you came to your original position and how you've evolved on that position over time. And I think as sort of like a historical background, that this is a conversation going on in leftist politics for a long time. So maybe you could tell us about, you know, where that came from for you.
So for me, it started when I was in third grade. And there was an election. Adlai Stevenson was running on the Democratic Party ticket. And Eisenhower was running for Republican. And in my school, Detroit Public Schools, great schools, we studied the candidates. We learned how to split a ticket. We studied the cabinets that people assumed were going to be in place for each of the candidates. And we were told that the day before our parents voted, we would have the exact same ballot as a secret ballot, and we would learn how to vote that way. So we voted the day before, and we can't come in the day of the election all excited, want to hear who won in our classroom. And my teacher stood up at the front of the classroom and held up a ballot, and she said, I know you're excited and want to know who won, but before we go into this, we have to discuss this ballot. Someone, and we all know who that is, and she looked at me, said, voted a split ticket, but voted for the Socialist Labor Party president and vice president and the rest Democrats. And we didn't study third parties, so this ballot will not count. And she ripped up my ballot. And that was my first introduction to voting and third parties. And I admit I have not voted for a third party since, because I felt that it just, there wasn't a point. It wasn't going to go anywhere. I voted when I was 21 only because I wanted to see what the process was like, and that was the voting age. I don't even remember who I voted for, what it was about. And I did not vote again until Bill Clinton was running, because I really did not feel that voting was going to change anything. In fact, what was the button that you stole from me?
Yeah, when I was 12, I stole a button. I think I was 12 at the time. I stole a button that said, no matter who you vote for, the government still gets in.
Right. And the government wasn't doing very well for any of us. I was active. I've been active, been arrested many times for a lot of different, you know, social causes and environmental causes and anti-war, but didn't vote until Clinton. And then I was convinced that there were going to be nominations for Supreme Court justice, and it was important to vote for a Democrat so we wouldn't get some horrible person for the rest of his or her life on the Supreme Court. And I was so, so disappointed in Bill Clinton because, okay, he nominated some okay people to the court, but he did terrible things for the rest of the country. Do I need to mention the things that he did?
I think people know.
Okay.
You particularly agree.
Well, it was upsetting because, one, he cut welfare, which now the results of that now is that we have more children living in poverty than any other industrialized country. At the same time that he cut the welfare, he increased by even more than that the amount of money going to prisons. So, and we have the school-to-prison pipeline, which is terrible. Deregulated the banks, which led to people losing their homes and their pensions and all of that stuff. So, I mean, I could go on and on. And then I voted for Obama because he looked like he really was going to make change. And he didn't. And it was disappointing again. Then I heard Bernie Sanders, and I said, okay, this is going to work. And I went and worked for Bernie Sanders during the primary. And then, the Democratic Party didn't work in a Democratic fashion, so he lost. And I knew I had to vote for Hillary because Trump. That was the only reason. But when Trump won, I decided, you know what? Working outside the party hasn't worked. I have to get into the party and change that. Plus, I see a whole lot more people going into the party to change how it works and, you know, maybe make it better for real people like me. So that's where I am today.
I think that's a story that I've heard from a lot of people of your generation, who, by the way, I honor for all of the things that's Bernie. You're Bernie's generation that fought for civil rights and against the Vietnam War in the '60s and for anti-poverty programs and all of that.
And environmental justice.
And environmental justice, exactly. So I guess the question is to Jennifer then, given that story of decades of trying to work outside the party to outside the electoral system, not just outside the Democratic Party, but outside the electoral system, either with third parties or independents or through activism, and the experiences of Tanya and Bernie's generation, Where do you think we are now, and what's your argument for, you know, actually this can work?
Sure. So I've never been a Democrat. Mm-hmm. I was always an independent. Mm-hmm. I had issues with the Democrat Party when I actually became active in politics. Really, when I was a kid, I was always on the peripheral of politics. Both of my parents were union. My dad was a sheet metal worker for Detroit Diesel. My mom was a public school teacher. Both of them were on strike in the 80s. And, you know, when I was a kid, I was about 7 years old. And George Bush the first was our president. And I would walk around saying, George Bush may be a Democrat. And I can pretty confidently say that Bill Clinton made me a Green. my very first presidential vote was in 2000, and I voted for Ralph Nader. I thought Al Gore was a terrible candidate, and I really had a big distaste for Bill Clinton, not even because of the economic reasons that you say, but because I was a teenage girl at the time, with all of like these scandals and how it was handled and all those kinds of things, I really got just a bad taste in my mouth for what was happening in Washington. And it was really kind of the first time where I was really paying attention to politics instead of just listening to my parents. I did vote for Barack Obama. I was going to vote Green in 2008. And I canvassed for Clean Water Action for 3 years. And that's also why I was never wanting to be party affiliated, because as someone who was an environmental activist, And seeing us endorse Democrats, I think we endorsed maybe two Republicans in like local elections. And the people that we endorsed would go to Lansing and I would see them talking a lot of talk about what they wanted to do and then a lot of excuses as to why we just got these little like breadcrumbs kind of falling at us. So I had a friend of mine who I canvassed with call me up. We had a long conversation. He's like, you have to get behind Barack Obama. He's a grassroots organizer just like we were. He's fantastic. He's amazing. And so I donated to his campaign and I did some work for his campaign. And I was ridiculously disappointed. And I kind of followed that. Well, like, oh, well, you know, lesser two evils. And I voted for him again. And then in 2016, there were three reasons why I joined the Green Party. So, of course, what happened to Bernie Sanders in the 2016 primary is one of the reasons. But the other two reasons are kind of more personal to me and more personal to us here in Michigan. The first was my quote-unquote progressive state senator attempted a hostile annexation takeover and dissolution of my school district. We got FOIA documents that showed that there were secret presentations being made to the governor's office. Local Democrats were kind of working behind the scenes against our school district. This Michigan Department of Education actually gave a grant to study the annexation of our school district without us ever being told until it was in the press. It was a really nasty piece of local politics.
Huh? Like the school, like the school board?
So I serve on my local school board, and I was president of the board at the time. So I was leading my school district towards systemic change. We had just hired a new superintendent, and the other school in my school district attempted to take us over in coordination with our state senator. I had to get a amendment pulled out of the school aid budget. There was a lot of just kind of backdoor shady politics that were going on, led by Democrats. And the other thing was in 2016, I was on the ground in Flint. So I had started my radio show podcast, The Offensive Feminist with Jenny Kay, in November of 2015. And I had been on the state board of the Michigan JCs where we were having our conference in Flint in October 2015. So the beginning of 2016, I was realizing after following the news for so long that there was misinformation being spread in the media because I would read one news article that would contradict another news article. And so I started just getting into the information, decided I was going to do a short 10 to 15 minute video via my podcast, which turned into an hour long documentary on everything that I found. And I spent 6 months researching everything that I could possibly find on the Flint water crisis. And the Democratic Party is just as culpable. In the Flint water crisis. And I personally went to the entire state legislature in 2017 in February, and I gave every single current sitting state senator and state representative a 5-pound packet of information, the four key documents, which shows that the state knew the difference between raw and treated water, and that Flint's water treatment plant could not properly treat water. And I also gave them a 28-page just annotated timeline. So I gave them the timeline so that there was something they would actually read and the documents to back it up. 5-pound packet of information personally hand-delivered to every single current sitting legislator, and not a single one of them have yet to do anything. So it's a partisan politics issue. And one of the questions, right, about third parties is that we're not viable, right? Is that we don't win electorally. And to be honest, I am the first candidate for the Green Party of Michigan who is actively running a grassroots campaign for this office. And so, sure, we haven't, you know, gotten to that point yet, but I would say as a party, one of my critiques of the party is we haven't tried.
Critiques of the Green Party.
Yes. Okay. And when I have been, you know, traveling around the state and speaking to people all over the state, people who lean conservative, people who lean liberal, and people who even fall in the middle, there's not very many people that I have spoken to that wouldn't look at me as a candidate and also are happy with the way our government is currently operating.
So, Eamon, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on today with this panel is because you wrote a piece that's up on the Progressive Caucus website called The Leftist Case to Vote for Whitmer. So what's your reaction to the stories that we've heard so far?
So first, thank you for having me. And I do really appreciate the history of activism on that other side of the table. It is quite impressive. I have a completely different background in politics. I practice politics in two different countries, in Egypt and here. I was never a progressive to begin with, so I moved from being conservative all the way and pro-establishment to becoming anti-establishment and towards and identifying as a socialist. So that was a complete change. But through the journey, I worked with different types of organizations, grassroots and whatnot. I'm also I'm an immigrant, and identify as an Arab and a Muslim, and I'm being identified as such. So definitely I have people of color's experience with the electoral process. So I have to say that you are not going to find many people of color who believe in the establishment, right? You are not going to find anyone who is in a minority group who actually is like hurrah, hurrah, Democrats or Republicans for that matter. They may act that way, but nobody is a true believer. And that includes Bernie Sanders. So I'll find a lot of people of color who supported Bernie Sanders, but nobody was a real believer in that Bernie Sanders is flawless or as a savior, or that is everybody in my community is quite ready for disappointment. So we have been disappointed a lot. And if we read history right, I think that's the smart thing, to lower our expectations in all mainstream politicians. So I just wanted to preface with that. The case to vote for Democrats is a very complex thing. It is not about Democrats in particular. So 100 years ago, or maybe a little bit more, around the Civil War, it was the Republicans, not the Democrats, we would have been talking about. So it doesn't matter to me whether we are talking about Democrats or Republicans. Or Greens or Libertarians or whatnot. But as you started in your introduction, you said that we have a system that was established by white rich men who wanted to preserve power and they were afraid of democracy. And while you're saying that we inherited a system that's a little bit better, I'm not so sure. I think that the system that we have right now is very much a plutocracy like before. I think it is just more disingenuous than the systems that were created initially. People were in your face. Only people who have property are going to vote. You have to be white to vote. And you have to be white to be a citizen, mm-hmm. right? So these were, and now there is a lot of deception mm-hmm. in how they operate that system.
So let me just say, by the way, I completely agree with you. But I do think that there have been some improvements, at least in the sense that more people are able to vote, even if they still try to suppress that vote.
Yes.
So in that sense, it's a very small thing. But behind the scenes, I think you're right. The way that it actually works behind the scenes, the Constitution is really designed to prevent as many people from voting as possible, and then to make their votes count as little as possible, and then to ensure that the plutocracy has control over who gets on the ballot. So there's a lot of barriers there, but it's still, I would still argue that at least we have the potential for everybody who's a citizen of age to be able to vote, even though we still have to fight that. For example, in Georgia right now, where they're holding up 53,000 voter registrations, 70% of which are African American. So,
but yeah, so this is the trick. So that's from my experience, even in Egypt, is that they give you officially or formally rights as long as they have a feeling, a very strong sense that the public is not going to invoke those rights, right? If so, they would say you have freedom of speech, right? As long as they think that you are not going to be able to use your freedom of speech. But once you are actually capable of doing that, then we start having another thing coming, right?
Free speech zones.
For example, right? So, or just very simply, I mean, you can have loud voices that drown or that make other voices mute, right? So we can spend, if there is a discrepancy in money and there are media establishments that can just basically outspeak everybody else, right? Then what is it, what does it matter that I have freedom of speech, right? And that applies, for example, to social media now and the internet, right? In that very short period of time when the people were capable of using the internet better than the establishment, right? We had some sort of capacity to express ourselves, but money came into play, and that is very, very quickly changing so that we are not on the same playing field, whether it's from net neutrality or even before that, right? Like with a platform like Facebook, and the way that you have all of these sponsored ads and the algorithms to target people and all of that stuff. So speaking of that, I believe that practically speaking, we are in a two-party system. We are not in a multi-party system. No matter what they claim, no matter what laws they have, we are squarely in a two-party system. Now, people want to change that. I don't want to change that in particular. I want to change the entire whole system of plutocracy, right? So I don't want to focus on this piece or that piece or get tangled in a side fight. My fight is about making that plutocracy into democracy and about social justice. But the electoral system we are governed by is a two-party system. So if I want to engage with it, I'm engaged with it according to that fact, right? If I don't want to engage with it at all and operate outside this, that's fine too, right? But there is, I mean, I can protest, right? Fine, there is a lot of room to protest and there is a lot of great ideas to protest. But if I'm engaging with the system for real and I'm not going into it just to protest or to make a point, then I have to acknowledge that it's a two-party system. And then my path to change or my path to influence the system is basically going to go to be based on that fact within that context. So that's where my article came from, right? So, I mean, that applies to Whitmer and applies for many other candidates, applies to presidential elections. I heard you talking about Obama and the change. At the time when Obama in 2008, I was still in my journey moving leftwards, so I was moderate. And I was so astonished with all the progressives who were so excited about Obama, because Obama for me was the typical moderate. I mean, I looked at his platform, I read his platform. In some issues of foreign policy, he was to the right of McCain. So McCain said, well, this is insanity, when Obama talked about targeting terrorists in countries like Pakistan. He said that in his before he was elected, in countries like Pakistan, without the consent of these countries. He talked about that, and progressives were cheering him on, and I did not understand that part. So I was supporting Obama as a moderate. And in 2012, I still supported Obama as a progressive from this point of view, but I was not oblivious to the fact that Obama was never a progressive. He was, in my opinion, center-right, so at best. So that is, and I didn't know why people thought otherwise. It still puzzles me. And when I talk about Clinton, I think Clinton's biggest problem, it's not that he eliminated the welfare, it's that he came from a party that is not supposed to do that and did that. I mean, if it were not Bill Clinton, if it was a Republican, he was going to eliminate the welfare, or is going to decrease welfare. I'm sorry, that's inaccurate. He didn't eliminate welfare, but he did cut it. Republicans would have cut it too. They would have cut it more. But the problem with Bill Clinton is that he made it okay for Democrats to do so. Not only that, there is a big generation of Democrats that are in the leadership of the Democratic Party who think this is the way to go. This is how we play politics. And that is the huge, big problem with him. That is a big deviation from Johnson and then Carter, what he did. The country shifted with Reagan. Republicans were trying to make sure they don't upset people and to preserve or to tell them that we are going to completely do away with the social safety net. Bill Clinton acknowledged that Reagan won the debate, the public debate, and acknowledged that we are now living in Reaganism, and decided that the Democratic Party is going to get on that train. That's his biggest sins.
So what is the, I didn't quite hear the case for voting for Whitmer though, the leftist case.
So if we are going to, if we are operating within two-party system, we're engaging in that system, then I have only two choices. I have Republicans or Democrats for the time being, whether to engage with Republicans or to engage with Democrats. So the choices are not, there is no, they're not equal by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. Bill Schuette is not Whitmer. Whitmer is not Bill Schuette. Now, putting myself on the side, and I am not Whitmer, mm-hmm. and I would have wanted someone else. I supported Abdul in the primary. Mm-hmm. And the difference is also big between the two. But I don't have that choice now. That's not one of the choices. The choice is Whitmer or Schuette. On November 7th, we'll wake up in the morning and we'll either have this one as a winner or this one as a winner. I'm sorry.
So let me ask, do you agree with that analysis? I mean, do you think that, do you believe that you have the opportunity to win this election?
You know, it's slightly hard to quantify, right? Okay. Simply because, I mean, I'm running against a ridiculous amount of money and a lot of media blackout. But when we think about how you can win the governorship, you have to win Flint and you have to win Detroit. Mm-hmm. And I've been on the ground in both of those places for the past 2 years, and I have a lot of name recognition in both of those cities. Mm-hmm. We have been building up the Wayne County Green Party and the Detroit Green Party for a long time, but specifically we've really been working. We had 5 Green candidates run in Detroit's local election in 2017. Mm-hmm. We have a really strong candidate running for the 13th Congressional District who has a lot of name recognition in the city of Detroit.
Who is that?
Deanna Wilcoxon.
Okay.
We have another candidate who has good name recognition running for the first state Senate seat in Detroit and Downriver, David Bullock.
Okay.
And we have a strong county commission candidate running in Flint. And we have a lot of supporters in Flint. Mm-hmm. And Flint and Detroit specifically are two cities that are really good examples of the failure of the Democrat Party, mm-hmm. And people that are looking for another option. And so goes Flint and Detroit, so goes much of the rest of the state as well. We have Green candidates running in the UP. We have a county commission candidate running for re-election in Traverse City, which is a very Republican area, and we have Green candidates in Kent County, in Jackson, in Washtenaw, in the city of Sturgis. We have some amazing grassroots candidates that are running write-in campaigns to unseat their city commission, but they can win with just 100 votes, who are actually most likely based on some of the groundwork and things that they've been doing and the unhappiness that their local city has, have the chance to uproot. In my town of Redford, people went to the ballot box and voted against my state senator, who was an incumbent. And they voted for someone who didn't campaign because they went to the ballot box and they said, absolutely not. I do not want this person. I'm voting for this person. And in the general election, they have other options, because there is no electoral politics in state politics. State politics doesn't have the electoral college. State politics is simply people running for office and people voting. And whoever wins is whoever wins. And so I think, while it's certainly, you know, a long shot, and I've been talking about climbing Mount Everest with my handmade grappling hook, The ground game and the things that we've been doing certainly give us some potential, if not to win this year, to win in the very, very near future, because there are a lot of cities across our entire state that are extremely unhappy with what has been given to them by the Democrat and Republican parties. And as much as you can try to change an organization from the inside, you cannot change a top-down corporation from the bottom up. It's just impossible. And when you look at the history of the Democrat Party and how people have attempted to change it from the inside multiple times over the past 100 years, and the fact that it has continued to move to the right every time that has happened, it is impossible to change. And so the only way to change our country is exactly what the Republican Party did with Abraham Lincoln. It's not like all of a sudden one day they popped up and nationally they had a presidential candidate. They built their party in state politics, and they had people running in state politics around the country. And once they were able to bring up people in state politics, then they were able to run a viable candidate, and they knocked out, I think it was the Whig Party, at the time. And so that is what the Green Party is currently doing. I mean, we grew by 400% last year. In Ohio alone, from last year to this year, they had another 75% increase in people grabbing their primary ballots. And of course, there's many people that don't show up to a primary. They only show up to a general election. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about changing our political system, the only way to change politics is to change your politicians. And the only way to change your politicians, and I don't want to talk about Abdul because he's no longer in the race, but I would certainly argue that Abdul is not a progressive.
What do you think? Are you convinced? Do you have
I'm scared.
Okay.
I'm scared to have enough votes taken away, I hate to say it this way, but taken away from Whitmer so that Schutte gets elected, because he's going to do terrible things to a lot of people. It's going to affect people's lives. On the other hand, I felt that way each time I voted for a Democrat and got bad things happening to people. So I'm torn about it. I'm really, really torn.
Well, so here is the thing. If we think that real change is going to happen this November, then there is a problem. We are only engaging with a process, and the change is going to have to happen over a long period of time. So I am not, again, I'm not going to be any more disappointed if Whitmer doesn't do things the way I want her to. I'm not expecting her to do. I'm not expecting Whitmer to govern as a progressive. I think she is way more progressive than a lot of Democrats, but that doesn't satisfy me by any means. I am not scared of, I'm not voting or supporting her because I'm scared. I think that I agree with Jennifer here on the idea that we need to build up from the bottom up a cadre of politicians until we are able to take over. I disagree with using the inception or of the Republican Party as an example to follow, because the context is completely different. What was allowed back then is not anymore allowed, and the establishment learns from its lessons. So the idea that any party is going to allow itself to be the Whig is completely out of question. Even the Republican Party itself is not going to allow the Democrats to be the Whig Party because they don't want their turn to come. So they will be in solidarity in that aspect. And I'm not talking about changing the Democratic Party from within. Every single person who went inside and had the arrogance to think they were going to go into the party and change it from within alone, or at least shift it a little bit, they failed. They either were absorbed by the establishment or expelled out. I am talking about a parallel organization, a group of people who are organized amongst themselves, who are engaging with the party. And I'm not talking about entering the party. I'm talking about engaging with the party as a group, building that kind of cadre, building that name recognition, until they are capable of replacing many of the politicians. Now, I am not going to predict how that's going to play out in the future. Things may change, and maybe the scenario that Jennifer talked about that happened back then, a context will allow for it to happen in the future. What I'm talking about today, the context does not allow for it. But in the future, maybe that entire group of people will be expelled out of the party. But by that time, they have chapters all around the state, and they have elected officials, and they have following, and I have name recognition. They would be the second party, not the third party. Expelling them would be actually a death sentence to the party itself. I don't know. I am not in the business of predicting so much into the future, but as long as my organization is growing and I am capable of spreading the ideology to more people, then I'm fine. I'm in the right track. A lot of people would hear me say that and would say, so, well, the Green Party is doing it their own way. You are doing it their own way. And whoever succeeds, that's great. Maybe at one point the context will be different and you guys are going to be the same organization. And I don't disagree with it, except that I see our engagement with the 1%. I see it as a fight, as an actual war with real casualties, with people dying. And in a war, it is morality here is about who are your casualties of war. You have choices when you are engaging in such a fight. Are you going to bomb a city and civilians die because that's going to win you the war? Are you going to allow yourself to do that, or are you going to take risks and avoid doing that so that you can protect some of those innocent people? This is, it's always that way in a war situation. In a war situation, you have allies that you don't like, that you maybe that you even despise. But you have to do that because others are going to be worse. And I'm not saying, I mean, the Mongols invaded much of the Arab world at one point, and a lot of Arabs at the time, they allied with the Crusaders that they have been fighting with for hundreds of years, that committed massacres among the population at the time, at least to neutralize them until they were able to free their land. So when I'm talking here about these elections, I see it exactly the same way. Yes, we are having you sitting in comfortable chairs, having the air condition on. I wanna that may deceive us into thinking like it's not an actual war, but no, people do die. People are separated at the borders from their kids. Kids are being adopted by families of different race, being acculturated, right? This is genocide. So, black folks are being shot on the street. My son telling me that I'm happy that we are protesting against ICE because I don't want to be taken away from you. So these are actual threats. So if I take my organization and join the Green Party and we all become more successful, what I am going to achieve in November 6, if I am more successful to get more votes than the usual 3% of voters who I know will never vote for Democrats or Republicans, they will always vote three party or stay home. So I'm not counting them as part of the process. But I'm talking if we are successful to go beyond that, then the guaranteed effect is for the Democrat to lose. And the casualties of that is what I do not want to see, and I don't think it is moral for me to accept. That's my point. So I want to continue to build my organization, do exactly the stuff that Jennifer is talking about without having to suffer those casualties.
What do you think about that?
So I would agree with you that we are at war with the 1%, but I would disagree with you that the Democrats are the lesser. When you look at Detroit Public Schools was destroyed by a Democrat. It was Jennifer Granholm. She's the one that put them back under emergency management after they came out of emergency management under Engler. They had a $2 billion bond that she said they weren't spending fast enough. And boom, money's all gone. The school district's destroyed. When you look at the Flint water crisis, it started prior to 2014 in the switch. It started prior to 2012 when Rick Snyder was elected. The first engineering report was in 2009. That was Jennifer Granholm. She gave out permits for oil and gas exploration that are still outstanding today when we talk about fracking. We now have a raw water pipeline, which is necessary for fracking, through a very rural section of our state where it is very possible many of those permits are at. Where we have seen in the past year, eight different natural gas plants have looked for either an expansion or a new build around the entire state, which means that these companies do not care if a Democrat or a Republican get elected. They know that they are going to frack our state. That is people's lives. People's lives, not just from fracking, but from the mercury emissions that currently are in 93% of our lakes and rivers. 43% of the counties in the state of Michigan have children with lead poisoning. And so I agree with you that these are people's lives. But what I disagree with you is that Democrats also are killing people just like Republicans are. The only difference, I think, between the two parties, and this is slightly a joke, but it's not really a joke, is that the difference between the two parties is that Democrats will send women and gay people to war. That is the difference between the two parties because policy, when you look at actual policy, Barack Obama took us from two wars that were illegal under George Bush to seven that are now continuing. He led the issue of the NSA spying on American citizens. He expanded the war powers of the presidency. He expanded all of these problems with the CIA, and other issues when we talk about people's lives. He was the deporter in chief. He deported more people than Trump did in his first year. I'm not saying that Trump isn't also terrible, because he is. But if we continue to think that the Democrats are better, when you look at policy and you compare the policies between these two parties, and not just policies, their actions and how they implement things, they are exactly the same in terms of ruining our country, ruining Flint, ruining Detroit, water shutoffs in the city of Detroit. The most water shutoffs in the whole city was under public health director, who ran for governor, who was lobbied to call a public health emergency and did not. You know, I mean, it's these kinds of things that when you look at people within both parties, they're both killing people. And if we don't do something to stop both of those parties, which is not just getting people to vote who currently vote for Democrats and Republicans. And I would say that I'm currently drawing people from both sides. Certainly, I would say there are actually probably more people that are progressive Democrats that are less likely to vote for me, and more people that lean conservative that are more likely to vote for me because of the fear factor, because the Democrat Party certainly campaigns on fear. But non-voters are actually one of my key pieces, is pulling people who are not currently in the process because they choose, just like you did, to not vote because they see two evils and there is no lesser. And so those are the people that I am actually actively working to engage, not just bring into the Green Party, but become voters because they have someone to vote for. And one of the things that people have always asked for when they talk about third party candidates, they want someone who has experience as an elected official. They want someone who understands things like finance, someone who understands the environmental issues, specifically in Michigan, because we're surrounded by so much water, and someone who understands policy, someone who understands how to implement things and has a background in those kinds of things. And that is exactly what I bring to the table. And the more people I am in front of, the more support I am gaining. And not necessarily from people that are going to be pulled from Whitmer. I would certainly say that I'm pulling people from Schuette. I'm certainly, there are people who may, I wouldn't even say that they may have voted for Whitmer, because people that are voting for me, 9 times out of 10, would never have voted for either of two people, whether or not they were ever engaged in the process or not. And there are more and more people. I think the percentage right now, last I saw, was about 60% of people who are registered voters consider themselves to be independent. It was about 45% nationally, and then it continues to increase almost every day, especially when you see some of these, you know, things going on, especially in national politics, right, with the disaster of the Kavanaugh hearing and those kinds of things. And so I have zero confidence, and I understand, you know, how you say that, like, voting for Whitmer is not, you don't expect anything from her, right? But until we change that mentality of voters, that I expect something from my politicians and I'm going to vote for the politician that is going to do something, you'll never have a change. And that is why we are kind of stuck in this limbo when we have been stuck in this limbo for my entire lifetime. And we don't have just one lost generation of children in public education. We now have two lost generations of children in public education, and that transcends party line. And all of these issues transcend party lines, because Democrats are just as terrible in policy as Republicans are. So the fear for me is that either of them get in. That is my fear.
So the thing is that the chance that we prevent that is almost non-existent. Let's be honest. Okay? Because, for example, you know, Jill Stein pulled 1.1% of the vote here. In the presidential election.
With no ground game and no get out the vote.
I agree, but you're talking about, for example, I really love what you're talking about in terms of local politics, because that's a place where I think that the Green Party and other third parties can actually be successful at this point in time. And
we are successful in that.
Well, marginally, I would argue. I mean, if you look at the total number of elected officials across the country,
except when you look at the percentage of Greens who are running for those seats and getting elected.
Well, no, that's a nice statistic, but the fact of the matter is that if you look at the total number of elected offices across the country and how many are held by anybody other than a Republican or a Democrat. Now, understand, like Eamon said before, I you know, it's certainly the case that the two major parties whatever else you may think of them, have worked together over the past 150 years since the Republicans knocked out the Whigs to ensure that there are laws in place that make that put barriers in front of third parties and independents to try to preserve the power of that of the two parties. The places where those barriers are lowest is at the local level and at the local or regional level within a state. So while I agree that that both party that both of the two major parties have terrible policies, I think that it's also true that one of them has some policies that are at least slightly helpful. There's at least, I mean, I think, for example, I think Whitmer makes, you know, as much as I disagree with her position on healthcare, because I mean, you know, because I think that it should be I think that it is a human right, and I think that our government should acknowledge that and actually have policies that that make that a reality. At least I haven't heard anything from her recently, but last time I checked, she was still talking about affordable care, which is just code for insurance companies get to make money. She did help to get 680,000 people some health care. That's not a whole lot in terms of the things that we could do, but it's really important to those 680,000 people and their families and their communities. And Schuette, especially with a Republican legislature, which we don't know how that's going to go, but that's another story. You know, is not interested in that, and is likely to follow in the lines of the Trump administration, trying to cut back on stuff like that. And that's going to be direct harm, and not just harm, but for some people, actually life and death, to have health care or not. So. I can understand running, for example, a statewide campaign that almost certainly will not win in order to build the momentum for a third party that's working in at the local level and building up support so that in the future there can be more progress in that direction, that's why I asked you, you know, do you really think that you can win? And when you talk about, you know, Detroit and Flint, to a certain extent, what you say is true, but it's also true that Detroit is well under 1 million people. Flint is about 100,000. There are just under 10 million people in the state. We can expect around 5 million to vote.
Detroit does not have more than 400,000 votes at this point.
Right.
Oakland County has more votes than that,
right.
And Detroit and Flint are only important for Democrats.
Right.
I mean, it's not the way
right.
that Detroit and Flint go, the entire state go.
Right.
That was not a correct statement.
Right.
I mean, Detroit and Flint can go one way and the entire state can go the other way, and it depends on the turnout.
Right.
Where did the turnout
right.
happen, and that's how... It
right.
was Republican or Democrats.
Right.
If Detroit and Flint do not go the Democrat way,
mm-hmm.
then the Democrats are definitely going to lose.
Right.
So that is that's part of the issue. So if the plan is to get more votes from Detroit and Flint from within the already 400,000 votes or the 50,000 or I don't know how many votes are in Flint. I know the population is around 100,000, but how many votes exactly are in Flint? Then we are talking about a Democratic loss. But if we're talking about...
What you're forgetting is that in a three-way race, you need a third of the vote, not 50%.
No, I understand completely. That is true. Now, if I'm going to go into statistics, right, I don't think we have a case here, because historical precedents and polling numbers and turnouts in the primary do not add up into an all of a sudden upset win for a third party. As much as I hate to be making that assessment, this is the reality based on numbers. I mean, Jim Webb stood up and said to Bernie Sanders in the only debate he was capable of being in, a revolution is not going to happen, and snickered, right? And then, but a revolution did not happen. So Jim Webb, my difference with Jim Webb is that he said it will not happen. He's not giving it a chance.
Right.
But Bernie Sanders wanted to give it a chance. Here's the issue. When we saw the votes in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, and afterwards, the numbers were not revolutionary numbers. Mm-hmm. I knew that the revolution was not happening. That doesn't mean that I will wish it away or work against it. I would still want it to happen in the future. But I knew that this year, we don't have a revolution happening. I know that in 2018, we don't have a revolution happening, right? There has to be a lot of things happening in order for us to get to a revolution. So it's revolutions don't happen in 4 weeks or in 3 weeks. But other than that, actually, there are lots of statements that have been made that I think could be superficially true, but when we get into the nuances, then they are not true. So both parties were going to allow for fracking. Okay, true, mm-hmm. right? But not all fracking are the same. Now, I want to do away with all fracking. People will call me a sellout. Oh, you're saying not all fracking is the same. Well, I'm saying if you're talking about people's lives, someone who's allowing fracking with a ton of regulation is very different from someone who's allowing fracking with no regulation. Now, the position that I want, which is no fracking, it's not going to happen. But definitely having a lot of regulation to make it meaningless, to make it very costly, and to eventually make it obsolete is a better position for me for the time being, since I can't get anything else. I was sitting the other day with someone from Clean Water Action talking about closing Line 5. And one of the strategies is to regulate Line 5 into oblivion, right? Now, I would want to close Line 5, shut it down completely, right? But also, if someone wants to do that, that means continuing to run Line 5 for a little bit longer. We're still running the risk of an environmental hazard, but trying to regulate it so much that Enbridge would decide to close it, right, is not an optimal situation for me. If I say both of them are going to let Line 5 continue, well, it's a true statement, but you get to the nuances. No, there is a huge difference between the two.
So I think there's a question of the theory of change that we have, and I actually don't think that we necessarily disagree on the theory of change. I think maybe part of the problem, part of the disagreement, maybe about what stage that we're at in the in progress towards change. And for myself, and I think what Eamon is saying also is that you know, we have a tool, this electoral system, and it's deeply flawed. What we're trying to do is we're trying to change that. We're trying to change that so that we can get actual representation of the people into government. We can say we want to do that right now, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the circumstances are such that we can actually make that happen. And to move towards making that happen, I think you have to look at it sort of like a little bit like an onion. You have to change the culture, the way that people think about politics and about how we engage with the government and how we engage with each other to make our circumstances better, and then you have to change. You have to use that to then get people into position to change the government. And right now, it looks to me like partly because of the way that the system is set up to make people afraid. To set up this duopoly that brings up this fear every election cycle, that drives a lot of people away from making that change. And what we have to do over the course of several election cycles is we have to build connections with people in our communities and across the state and across the country to build the idea that, yeah, we can actually do this, and we can do this if we are all get active in that. And in the meantime, we push as we push every day, either side of election day, for greater interconnection in our communities, greater understanding of the situation, and driving people, driving ideas out so that people can think about, you know, how we might change what we're doing. And then on election day, okay, you you do the best that you can, and hopefully we have a lot of down ballot races that can have a really serious impact that can actually be won. I think that's a theory of change that isn't about that isn't about we have to do it this election, not because I don't want to do it this election, but because you look at the reality and you say what's the situation and what can we actually accomplish. Do you think that's a wrong assessment? Or?
Well, I would say there's kind of two issues with your assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is, you assume that the general population is as engaged in partisan politics as those of us at the table are.
I'm actually totally not assuming that. I'm assuming that people are not as engaged in politics at all.
Correct.
And that as a result, it takes a lot of effort over years, not just a few months in election, in a particular election, but several cycles, mm-hmm. to continuously put our narrative out,
mm-hmm.
And not just, I don't mean any particular narrative, I mean there's a lot of narratives from progressives, mm-hmm. Across the country, and get people thinking about this to get them motivated to that. So I'm not at all thinking that people are really engaged in partisan politics the way that people hear of.
I'm just saying, people that are not engaged in partisan politics, mm-hmm. don't care about the letter next to somebody's name.
Mm-hmm.
They look at issues and that individual person. The other thing is that what I'm hearing in your arguments,
mm-hmm.
that are pro the Democrat Party, is what I would, is a lot of passive language. Like, we're trying, we really want this to happen, we think this might happen, those kinds of things.
I hear the same thing from you in terms of your race, though.
Well, except, you know, I certainly am like a realist and understand that like I am in a steep battle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially like monetarily and
sure.
media wise, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at change and we look at progress, and what you wish and you want to happen, what I'm hearing from you guys,
mm-hmm.
Is not something that is ever going to happen working inside the Democrat Party.
So I don't
think... Or supporting Democrat candidates. The only way, when you talk, because you both have said that you want to change, like,
mm-hmm.
the local politics and change local politicians,
mm-hmm.
The only way to do so is by electing people and by working for
mm-hmm.
candidates who are not inside that two-party system. So if that is something that you want to do and you want to help, then what you need to do is find those candidates and not have them run in a Democrat primary. Because you look at what happened in Michigan in the primary, the Democrat Party operates by stacking primaries to ensure that the people that they want to win, win.
It's the same process. The primary process is the same as the it's not controlled by the Democratic Party. It's the same as the general elections. So what makes anyone think that you cannot succeed in the primary, but you can go on and succeed in the general elections?
No, what I'm saying is that you bypass the Democrat primary. You just don't engage in the Democrat primary. Like,
but
I've been running.
But in Michigan, the Democratic primary is not closed to anybody. We can go out there and campaign with independents and with Greens and with anybody else and say, show up and vote in the primary for the progressive candidate. Yeah. So how is that? So what Eamon is saying is that because that's an open primary, if it was a closed primary system, that would be different. Okay. And especially in Michigan, you know, there's a lot of criticisms that I have of the Democratic Party. One of them is that when you join, you have to wait 30 days to vote. But one of the things that I commend them for is you can vote in the party just by joining, even though you have to wait 30 days. So
you're talking about party membership.
I'm talking about party membership.
You're not talking about the actual politics side.
Let's not get into that.
Right.
I'm talking about the actual open process.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the total number of votes received by all the progressive candidates who ran in Michigan is way more than any Green Party member won in Michigan ever, and way more than the anticipated number of votes they are going to receive in a general elections.
For example, to give some statistics, Abdul got 340-some thousand votes in the primary, and Jill Stein got just over 50,000 votes in the past election.
In the general elections.
And Gary Johnson even only got 172,000.
Your reach is way more. And by the way, since you mentioned Abdul again, I think it's a complete mischaracterization of his record in the Detroit public health about the water shutoffs. But this is a complete issue that we can get into and can get into it later. But back again to the issue of I don't think that we are approaching it from a passive point of view. I think we are determined to build an organization that is grassroots, that continues to preserve its ideological discipline, regardless of where the Democratic Party moves, and continues to operate that way, grows its number, grows its reach, right? And every year reassess what the strategy is going to be based on the current context. What works for 2018 is not going to be the same thing that will work for 2020. So, and keeping all the options open, keep all the operatives on their toes at the same time. But we are determined and we see that we are progressing and increasing in numbers. So I don't see that as passive at all. And if it was that way, we wouldn't have found such resistance from the Democratic establishment for our existence. But for a candidate to come up to run and get 20,000 votes or 25,000 votes in a congressional district, running in the primary, reaching all of these people, getting his name recognized, getting people to reassess their vote afterwards and say, I had a choice of so-and-so versus so-and-so, right? I can tell that there are our congressional progressive candidates who ran for Congress got more name recognition in Michigan than Jill Stein, each single one of them, than any Green Party member who would run all across the state. That's my point. I don't think that's a passive message. The passivity here is talking about what can be achieved in 4 weeks in this particular elections, not talking about the long term. We are going to win. The 99% are going to win that fight. I have no doubt in my mind about that.
It's a question of how fast and how deep we can organize. That's something that takes time and effort and energy over several cycles, I would argue. So I agree with him, and I don't think that we're being passive. Progressives that have chosen to dem enter, for example, and we have had some successes. I don't know if you're even in the face of a lot of opposition from establishment Democrats, both in terms of changing party rules. To increase transparency, accountability, and democracy. We didn't get everything that we wanted, but we've gotten we've made some significant progress, and I expect that there's going to be plenty of resistance. But the fact of the matter is that the Democratic Party, unlike the Republican Party in this state, by the way, doesn't require that you get elected as a precinct delegate in order to vote in their convention. So it really is a situation where we can organize people in Michigan to enter the party and change the rules to be more democratic and to prevent the kind of top-down control that party leaders have typically exercised. You say that that's impossible to do. So can you explain why that would be impossible?
So I'm not familiar with the inner workings of the Democratic
Sure.
Party, right? I've never been a Democrat, but the Democrat Party is a corporation, and it is a top-down corporation. And as much as you can change some of the rules within how they operate, mm-hmm. You cannot change the top, which is the top down. And what they work towards is exactly what you all are doing, right? Which is you have to keep voting for our establishment candidates when your candidates,
that.
But you're voting for the establishment candidates, right? We ran
mm-hmm. in the primaries mm-hmm. and we supported those candidates mm-hmm. and I think that there are a lot of people on the progressive side who are in the Democratic Party now who aren't necessarily voting straight ticket all the way. You know, they're voting for the people that they think that they can win and will provide some kind of triage, like Eamon was talking about, to prevent even worse stuff than what we'll get with the Republicans.
But I have no problem continuing to vote. They want us to vote for their candidates, and I'm voting for their candidates. I'm not doing it for them. I'm not being tricked
right.
for them.
Right.
I'm doing that temporarily for my own purposes.
Right.
So it doesn't bother me mm-hmm. at all that I'm doing. I would be bothered if every time I'm feeling cornered
right.
into doing that.
Right.
I am assessing the field, the context, and I'm engaging with it based on my own terms,
mm-hmm.
right? The fact of the matter is you don't choose your enemies. You don't choose many of your allies. You don't choose the players on the field, right? That's the hand you are dealt, and you deal with it on your own way. So this is part of our plan. I don't care if they're happy for the time being that we are giving them our votes. So what? But who is organizing better,
mm-hmm.
and who is widening their circle, or whose ideas are spreading more?
Mm-hmm.
That's all that matters to me. And from my experience, actually, in with the Egyptian Revolution, people want activists who actually bring about results. They want activists who understand what's possible, right? And they want them to also, they want two conflicting things at the same time. They want to make sure that they have integrity, but they also want to make sure that they are pragmatic enough and they know the lay of the land, they know how to get things done. And when people looked for leadership, they looked for the most conservative organization out there for leadership, which were the Muslim Brotherhood at the time, because they were very organized, because they had representatives in government positions at the time, because they ran for offices before, right? Although they were very much pro-establishment, because they didn't find among the true leftists people who engaged with the system and who were delivering for them some kind of services, no matter how little they are. I don't want to look in the eyes of someone and tell them, I am not doing anything to improve your life. I have all of these plans that I have no path in getting these plans passed, and I am not going to do anything to improve your life, to get one more person covered by healthcare or give them more access. But that's because these are my values and I don't want to compromise them. They are not going to look at us when there is a revolution for real, people rising up in millions and millions of numbers of millions, right? They're not going to be looking at me for leadership at the time. They're going to be looking for the best thing at the time that was able to deliver services and engage with the system. And that's going to be someone way to my right. And I don't want that to happen.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you a couple of times, so I apologize for that. And if you want to go back to what you were saying.
No, I mean, that's a good point when you talk about people engaging in the system and delivering results, right? Except, I mean, speaking for myself, right? Like, I have engaged with the system and I have delivered results.
And that's
like,
admirable.
That is in my background. I have fought the Democrat Party to keep my school district alive. I was able, as an individual, as a school board president, pull an amendment out of the school aid budget by using connections and resources and engaging in the system in the way that I need to.
How did that happen, by the way? Were there some politicians that helped you with that? I mean,
So actually I went to one person and gave them all of the information as to what was happening and how that was going to impact not just my school district, but other school districts around the state, as including some of the issues of systemic sexism and racism that were embedded in this issue, and was able to make it happen.
Who was that, by the way?
Bert Johnson.
Bert Johnson. I don't know.
He
was a state senator. He is now currently incarcerated. He was actually one of the people, he was the only current sitting legislator who endorsed Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And he and I had actually had a very long conversation about the problems with the two-party system. Mm-hmm. And later on, we started having a conversation about joining the Green Party. Mm-hmm. And we were recruiting him to run for governor. Mm-hmm. And we had two meetings. In the week of our third meeting, where I'm pretty confident he was going to say yes, he was going to flip parties and join us and run for governor under the Green Party ticket. That Monday, his office was raided by the Michigan State Police and the FBI, and that Friday was when our meeting was going to happen. I'm not saying that that's...
Right.
I mean, potentially coincidental, right? When you talk about, you know, long investigation and things like that. But there certainly is, you know, an aspect when you look at who in the Democrat Party would ever support any kind of those policies. Mm-hmm. And then you look at people like Andrew Gillum down in Florida, right, who ran on a platform in the primary. And then as soon as he made it past the primary, changed his platform and how he was speaking. Same with Ocasio-Cortez in New York, changed some things on her platform and anti-war speech and things like that, and supporting, you know, people within the party. And so when you talk about like that kind of inter-party politics, it's still a machine that is owned by corporations and is run as a corporation. And so as much as you push within, it is, so the resistance is built into the mechanisms of the party.
So I don't necessarily disagree with you that it, I mean, obviously it's run top down, but the fact of the matter is, so is
it's
government.
Not run top down, it is structured top down.
Sure, it's structured top down, absolutely. We want to talk about structure, I'll talk about structure all day long. And that makes it, and that does make it difficult. But just like in our broader electoral system, you know, voting can make a difference, it can make a difference in the sense that you can actually change the people who are in the leadership of the party, from that point, you can change the way that the party works to make it more democratic, to make it more open to other people. and build power inside the party, as Eamon said, with a group of people that aren't just working inside but are also working outside. So, for example, I am fully in favor of the Green Party doing a lot of the work that you guys are doing. I think that's great. I think we should have multiple parties, but we're going to have to change the system before we can actually have multiple party system. We have to get rid of, for example, plurality winner first past the post voting. That causes a lot of this problem at the polls where you can eliminate your second choice by voting for your first.
But again, you're not going to have any of these changes. You're not going to have any of these changes, and unless there is a huge public pressure,
right?
And you're not going to have public pressure unless you organize the people. So my issue is,
yeah,
I am looking for my opportunity to organize. I'm looking for a platform where I can talk to people, mm-hmm, and an opportunity to organize. I'm not looking for making a two-party system into a three-party system or a four-party system. I'm not making for changing how we vote, mm-hmm, because all of these things, mm-hmm, right, is basically demands to the plutocracy to,
right,
reform itself.
Right.
It's not going to. Right, you have to have that tremendous, huge public pressure.
Right.
That happens only from organizing.
Yes.
Right. Government itself is structured top down.
Yeah.
So if you are talking about Alexandria in New York, right, and that she's switched positions, arguably a Green Party, mm-hmm, member winning and going into Congress would face the same amount of pressure from the top down and would change the position. It's not because she ran into the Democratic Party,
right?
Primary that she may be switching position. That's hypothetically, because that mm-hmm also require a longer, nuanced discussion. Mm-hmm. But it's the pressure is coming from the system, which is the Democrats are only part of.
Right. So you've been quiet for a while, listening to this back and forth with the long history behind you of this of these discussions. What do you think so far?
I keep coming back to the part about it being a corporation and money, and part of the problem that any other party, any third party has, is getting into the media so that people know that they're there and what they stand for. And in the system that we have now, you have to have money to do that. And power, because, I mean, Trump didn't spend a whole lot of money. He just called people up. But we don't have any of that. And in terms of going into the Democratic Party, one of the problems is a big part of the people, of the job of the people at the top, is to get money. And none of us want to do that. It's, you know, we want to get money out of politics.
Right.
So we can't push out the top people because we need them to get the money for the whole thing to run. I'm just totally confused. I feel terribly frustrated. I don't think that any of the people that we're going to elect are going to be able to do half of the things that we would like them to do.
Or even want to necessarily.
Right. And it is disappointing when people that you have supported change their position once they get nominated. I suspect a whole lot of it has to do with the pressure to get the money.
Well, and part of it, so when you talk just on micropolitics, on the state politics, the parties control the state representatives and state senators' access to their constituents. And so there was an instance where I know a local politician who voted the way the party did not want them to vote on a bill, and was cut off from access to emailing and mailing their constituents for 2 months because of that. Now, the difference between how you were saying that a Green candidate would change their position, I would certainly argue that that is not the case. every elected green politician that is out there. I have never seen those kinds of changes. Certainly, like, when you talk about negotiations and going through bills, of course, but that is not changing your position. That is going through the negotiation process of legislative. But you start with a position, you don't change your position. Because there are hard values of the Green Party, our 10 key values that are the values that every single person that joins the Green Party agrees that those are your values. And when I look at people like Kenneth Mejia in California, Rodolfo in California, Deanna in Detroit, and some of our other congressional candidates that really have a chance in their races when we talk about changing Congress, is having those people in Congress, they are going to be arguing for the green position, which is a different position from the Democrat position, and is cultivated by the values of our party, which are different from the Democrat Party, because we do have different values from the Democrat Party. And so when we look at those kinds of things, we look at, there's always a negotiation process, but I have never seen a green candidate change positions, even in, you know, Kenneth and Rodolfo in the, because California has their top two primaries, and so they did have to go through a primary and then go into a general election, and neither of them changed any of their positions after the primary, and so I would certainly argue that that would not be the case for green candidates, and the green candidates, when they have positions, those are their positions, and they do not change them, because we are guided by our principles of the party. And even in media, so I have been getting media, I just haven't been getting mainstream media. I have been finding, because I've been an organizer for a long time, right? So I have been finding all of the ways that I can get small local media and small local attention, as well as going to like large events and speaking with, you know, thousands of people personally. So like personally, like touching and having conversations and shaking hands with people at large events. But, you know, like the Westland Gazette and my local Redford paper and the local Sturgis paper when I was just in Sturgis yesterday. And so it's those kinds of things that are helping that you would not see on a statewide level at all, because it's just impossible. Those papers mm-hmm. don't get sure. That kind of stuff. But there are ways that we have been working, and not just myself, of course, our other green sure. candidates. And this year, certainly, especially, we are working more as a team than I think we ever have as a party before. Mm-hmm. You know, Tom in Trevor City has my literature, and he has Sherry Wall's literature, who's running for State Board of Education, and is handing them out when he's doing his stuff. And our candidates in Kent County are doing the same thing, and our candidates in Sturgis are doing the same thing, and our candidates, wherever we are, we are helping all of our other candidates in that same area as well. And that's certainly hard to quantify, and we certainly know, as a political scientist and people who've been in politics for a long time, there's only so much you can grasp from polls because of the inherent issues of polling and things like that. And I'm certainly not saying that, like, oh yes, I know 100% I'm going to win, right? But I certainly don't think that I don't have a chance. And it's because of the organizing and the grassroots way that not just I'm running my campaign, but the way other green candidates are also in their campaign. Certainly, I think personally, I have the most presence in Flint and in Detroit, simply because I live across the street from Detroit, and I've been active in Detroit for the past 2 years, and I've been active in Flint for the past 2 years fighting with the residents on the Flint water crisis. But that doesn't mean that there isn't also a presence in other spots of the state and things like that too. Plus you have, you know, online and people who look at, you know, just do their own research and come to their own conclusions. I just think it's an interesting year. I'm certainly looking forward to seeing like what the results are going to be. I also think that when we look at the Green Party specifically, even just achieving that 5% threshold, if that's the bare minimum that we get, is going to drastically transform our party. And I think that another candidate has a real good shot at for sure reaching that threshold as someone who people consider to be running for a safe seat for a Democrat, which would be Marcia Squire, who's running on the Green Party ticket for U.S. Senate. There's a lot of people who are Democrats who are very unhappy with Debbie Stabenow, and a lot of independents who are very unhappy with Debbie Stabenow. And Marcia has been running an online campaign for a very long time, and she has somewhat of a ground game. I wouldn't say that she has the kind of ground game that my campaign has, but she has been just running her campaign in a different fashion. And so when we look at people that are looking for alternative candidates, you know, we have a lot of them around the state of Michigan this year.
So a couple of things. By the way, I want to point out that the specific thing that you mentioned about cutting off people's access to their constituencies, mm-hmm. that's actually one of the things we can actually change by, you know, taking positions of power in the Democratic Party.
Sure.
I think that's one of the kinds of things that I think is useful to do by organizing inside as well as outside to create that kind of pressure. We've got to wrap up here, but any last thoughts from people? Last thoughts from anybody?
Now I can sum up my position saying that engaging with electoral politics, its primary objective is to organize and to provide an opportunity for people to increase their engagement, right? So whatever engagement it is, it has to lead to that without many casualties as possible. I think that anyone who's running for office, that's very brave, very admirable, especially running as an underdog. That is, I know very well how brave that has got to be. And the last thing is, we have to be very careful that anyone who wins without a mandate, with a low turnout, with the majority of people at home, they don't have the capacity to make huge changes at all. So real, real big changes only happen if you win with a huge, huge mandate from the people.
I'll say thank you for having me on. I always enjoy these kinds of discussions, especially as a political science nerd. And, you know, I understand why people want to organize within the Democrat Party. I would say I've never wanted to be a Democrat. I don't agree with the Democrat values. I agree with the Green Party values, and that is why I'm a Green. And that is why I'm actively, you know, promoting the Green Party, a member of the Green Party, organizing in the Green Party, and continue to grow and expand the party and change the face of Michigan politics.
I'm sorry, I have to say one thing about that, because that's actually a big deal for me, is that I actually think the way that you talk about that is an authoritarian way of thinking about what it means to be part of a group. In an authoritarian way of thinking, when you join a group, you become like the group. In a democratic way of thinking, when you join a group, the group becomes more like you. Okay, and, you know, so I would encourage, by the way, I would encourage Greens to join the Democratic Party, because it doesn't make you a Democrat. It makes the Democratic Party more like us, more like Greens and progressives and other people who are trying to move politics beyond the establishment. And I think that I would object to thinking about it that way, because that's really dividing us, where in fact progressives and leftists could be much more united if we said, you know, joining the Democratic Party doesn't make me a Democrat. It makes me a person who's in the Democratic Party trying to change it to something that will actually be useful to me and to the rest of the people. So, and I would encourage people to join the Green Party as well. There's no reason that you can't be a member of multiple parties. It's a free country, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, right? I don't know if you would agree with that or not, but I'm sorry.
I would disagree. I would not encourage people to ever join the Democrat Party.
Okay.
That is, I don't agree with the Democrat Party.
Okay. Understandable. Well, thanks everybody for your time. I think it's been a good discussion, and I appreciate everybody's input. Looking forward to see how the rest of the campaign season goes. Thanks very much.
Thank you.